the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
It's good to be here. May I add my welcome to Saz and to Chris as well. We're going to be looking at this passage together. As we've already said, this is a series looking at these well-known sayings that come right at the start of the Sermon on the Mount, commonly referred to as the Beatitudes. The reason why they are so named is because it comes from the Latin Vulgate translation of the Bible, which starts each of these proverb sayings with the word beati, the word which we have translated as blessed or rich. And for the purpose of this series, we're going to split our talks up into four talks. We're going to look at the traditional eight Beatitudes that are there, that are shown in the way that they are as typeset in the NIV. They're often split up into four sets of two, or they're also split into two sets of four. You can do either, really, them. And I hope as the series unfolds, you'll start to see why the pairings work, because I think they do. And you get to understand why there are four sets of two. But it's also worth noting, I think, the reasoning behind the alternative method, which is to split them into two sets of four. Frederick Dale Bruner is quite helpful when it comes to this in his commentary on Matthew. He writes that the first four, and if you look at them, they describe our need. Poor, mournful, meek, and hungry. And that the second four, he says, describe things that we do to help. Merciful, peacemaking, and as he puts it, in fact, in his book, getting harassed for trying. And he summarizes the Beatitudes like this. God helps those who cannot help themselves, and he takes those as being the need Beatitudes. He also helps those who try to help others. Those are the help Beatitudes. But this is the interesting bit. But he does not, in any Beatitude, help those who think they can help themselves. And I want you to keep that in mind as we delve into these first two Beatitudes. He doesn't, says Bruner, in any Beatitude, help those who think they can help themselves. Now, over the centuries, there's been a wide variety of interpretations placed upon these few verses. Some have even suggested that it's rather impossible to decipher exactly what Jesus is really meaning by the Beatitudes. But I think actually the answer when it comes to thinking about meaning in reality is far more obvious and it's far more accessible than we may think, because I think the key to understanding them, the key to interpreting these verses, is found by following the example of the living embodiment of these truths. You see, Jesus' whole life is a commentary on these eight statements. If you want to understand them, then we only have to look at his character, at his actions, at the teachings of Jesus. And that's the reason, in part, why week by week we're going to set alongside the reading of the Beatitudes an incident from Jesus' life to illustrate each pair of the Beatitudes. So we're going to just set the scene. Imagine for a moment that you're attending a large conference. It's almost time for the keynote speaker to stand up to address those present in the auditorium. Expectations are high. Everyone's getting comfortable in their chairs. Phones have been switched off. The speaker steps onto the stage. He walks up to the lectern. He arranges his notes. And all at once, the auditorium is completely silent. And the speaker starts his keynote address. This is it. This is the moment. And in a sense, this is the modern equivalent of what Matthew conveys when he writes at the start of chapter 5. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. And the most important words in the opening sentence come right at the end. They are the last two words, sat down. And the significance of this is simple. Itinerant teachers in Jesus' time, the rabbis of Jesus' day, taught as they walked. That's what they did. Teaching was done on the move. It was only when a rabbi had something particularly important to say that he would sit to teach. That means, of course, that the importance of the Sermon on the Mount as we have it cannot be overstated. Here is Jesus' manifesto. He's launching his teaching. So this is his first major recorded teaching moment. Jesus has the hushed attention, doesn't he, of his disciples directly in front of him, as well as this large crowd that is sort of fanning away from him down and across the mountainside. And he starts with these words. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Over the centuries, there has been much written about the meaning of the word that we have translated in our Bibles as blessed. The reason for all of the writing is because we actually don't have a direct English comparison for the word, which is Greek, which is Makarios. And Greek is, of course, the original language of this gospel. Other translations, such as the Good News Bible, for instance, go for happy. And actually, they choose that with really good reason. Although the first century understanding of happiness is quite dissimilar to the way that we use the word today. So unfortunately, when we read happy, it isn't actually what's meant anyway. So it's very, very difficult to interpret the word. Robert Wilkin, writing in his book, Seeking the Face of God, he says this about happiness. For us, happiness is a transient state. It arrives and departs as circumstances change or fortune intervenes. For the ancient, happiness was a possession of the soul. Something that one acquired, and that once acquired could not be easily taken away. Happiness designated the supreme aim of life, living in accord with nature, in harmony with our deepest aspirations as human beings. So we can look at different translations and we can see different ways of expressing this word blessed. Now, for me at least, I like Tom Wright's translation of the passage. This comes in one of his For Everyone series of books. He translates blessed are as wonderful news for. Let me say that again. He translates blessed are as wonderful news for. And Wright's argument is simply this, that Makarios is so much more than blessed or happy. So this is what he does with the first two Beatitudes that we have in view this evening. He translates them as this. Wonderful news for the poor in spirit. The kingdom of heaven is yours. Wonderful news for the mourners. You're going to be comforted. And I think Wright's translation is really, really helpful. It gets right to the heart, I think, of the way that we should view these sayings. You see, the danger is that we could interpret them as attitudes that we need to attain to. This is a little bit like a wish list of sort of self-imposed piety. But Jesus isn't an ascetic. He doesn't campaign for a life of poverty and self-denial, and neither is he anti-aspirational. Jesus wants his followers to enjoy life to the full. He wants them to know the benefits of the kingdom. We know that to be true because when we get into John chapter 10, we find John quoting Jesus' words, words we thought about a couple of Sunday mornings ago. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. The danger is we'll look at the Beatitudes, and especially these first two, in rather a negative light. And that's because of the words that they use and because of the meanings that we attach to those words, which, as we'll see in a minute, aren't necessarily the meanings we ought to attach to those words. But I think we should view them in a much more positive light. You see, these verses aren't a list of people who God blesses. This isn't a list of pious ideals that we should be working hard to achieve. They aren't vague promises for the future. They don't describe a moral code. They aren't good advice. In fact, they are good advice. News. They are gospel. Wonderful news for the poor in spirit. The kingdom of heaven is yours. Wonderful news for the mourners. You're going to be comforted. So Jesus isn't saying, well, try hard to live like this. In fact, more of what he is saying is the people who are living like this are the people who are living under the authority and the rule of the kingdom. This is what kingdom living looks like. These are the people who are reflecting God's heart. And that is wonderful news. You see, something momentous is happening. Jesus is announcing to everyone, right at the start of what he has to say at the Sermon on the Mount, he's announcing to everyone who will listen that the world's values are being turned on their head. The kingdom is coming. God is breaking into the world. Something radical is happening. If you're old enough to remember the 1970s, there was a period when it seemed like every other film to gain a similar cinema release was a disaster movie. And some, like The Poseidon Adventure, in fact, have been remade since, goodness knows why. But in case you've never seen the film, The Poseidon Adventure is the story of this luxury ocean liner. It's the SS Poseidon. And as you can guess, because it's a disaster movie, disaster strikes in the form of an enormous freak wave that flips the whole liner upside down. So what was the top of the ship is now the bottom. The hull is above the water, the deck is several meters below the water level. Everything is upside down. And the story of the film, of course, deals with how people respond to this extreme disruption. They need to work out how to escape. And you can imagine, of course, this is the plot, isn't it? There are disagreements amongst the passengers and amongst the crew about who they should follow. Who shall we follow to get out of this situation? What's the best route to get out? What's the safest way to exit? And Jesus is rather like this enormous wave. His arrival turns everything upside down. The world's value system has been flipped. And the Beatitudes sets out these clear indicators of what upside down living looks like. Or perhaps, more helpfully, the Beatitudes reveal what living the right way looks like in an upside down world. But it takes time to adapt to living upside down. What was the ceiling is now the floor. What was going up is now going down. But the good news and the best news, the wonderful news, as Wright puts it, is that we have someone to follow. If we want to learn how to live in the upside down kingdom, then all we need to do is to stick close to the king, to Jesus himself. And as the gospel writers reveal, of course, Jesus didn't simply teach about the kingdom. He lived out the principles of the kingdom. He lived the values of the principles of the kingdom in everyday life. Every single attitude that we read in the list of Beatitudes was demonstrated and modeled for his disciples to see and to copy. And that raises an important point, I think, because many commentators suggest that the Beatitudes are sort of a list of the types of people that God blesses. In which case, it rather suggests that we can sort of pick and choose a little bit which beatitude may fit us better because of our personality type. But that's not the case. This is a single description of a kingdom dweller, of somebody who possesses and professes to be a citizen of God's upside-down kingdom. And I think that's borne out by the fact that this entire section is bookended. We get, theirs is the kingdom of heaven in verse 5, theirs is the kingdom of heaven in verse 11. This is a set. This describes an upside-down kingdom dweller. So with all of that in mind, how ought we to best understand the first two Beatitudes? Well, Jesus starts his keynote speech with this remarkable statement. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I think what Jesus is celebrating here, the thing that we should have in view as being wonderful news, is that he's not actually talking about those who are materially poor, but those who are fully aware of their need of God. Blessed are the poor in spirit. But it is true at the same time that Jesus has a love for and an affinity with those who were materially poor. It's a theme, isn't it, that we see time and time again throughout Scripture. We repeatedly read about God's people needing to reveal God's heart for redressing injustice in every situation where inequality has taken hold. But that's not really the kind of poverty in view here. It's different in nature. And yet there are some similarities as well. Now, if you know something of the Sermon on the Mount, I wonder if I was to give you a little bit of homework to think about what you would choose to be the central verse of the whole of the Sermon on the Mount. I have one. I think it's this one. It comes in chapter 5, verse 20. There we read this. "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." I think this is the main theme of the whole sermon. To my way of thinking, righteousness is what the whole sermon is about. It's all about the basis of our standing before God. It's to do with our rightness in the light of God's holiness. And being poor in spirit means that we recognize that we are by and of ourselves unable to claim any rightness at all. So when we recognize that we are poor in spirit, it's all about acknowledging our need for a right relationship with God. We are created by God. We owe God everything. God's the source of life. He's the one whose endless creative outpouring sustains our life. So when we recognize our own spiritual poverty, that's when we understand our need of him. It's then that we fully embrace Christ's kingship. We start to live life in the upside-down kingdom. We inherit the kingdom. We are those who profess and live under the kingship of Jesus Christ. But, going back to that key verse, as we read through the Gospels, the religious leaders of Jesus' day don't seem to appreciate this. And we read it, didn't we, in the parable that we just read from Luke 18. The religious leaders paraded this external, artificial righteousness. It was based on rule-keeping. But the righteousness that God requires isn't one based solely on conduct. It's a righteousness that's based on character. And the character we need to have requires radical heart surgery because it's not our sin-tainted character. It's Christ's character. And so it's that recognition that without God's intervention, there can be no wonderful news for us, no transformation. The upside-down kingdom has upside-down values. And to be a citizen, we have to acknowledge that it all starts with our acceptance of the fact that we are spiritual paupers. So what does that look like for us in the everyday? What does it look like to recognize God's kingship? What does it look like to learn to live increasingly God-focused lives? Well, I think right at the basic level, it's about wanting to spend time with God. It's about time spent in prayer and through reading his word. It's about following the example of the one who perfectly embodies all of the Beatitudes. It's about allowing God's spirit to change us, to shape us, to be increasingly useful in his service. And the reason why I think one leads into two is because this poverty of spirit leads us directly into this thinking about mourning. But mourning here isn't necessarily the same way as we would think of it naturally when we use the word. I think these two Beatitudes are crucially linked. Although the theme of mourning, rather like the theme of poverty, doesn't necessarily directly relate to the most obvious meanings that spring to mind. I think the mourning that's in view here is much broader in its context. You see, when we recognize our personal poverty of spirit, it leads us to this wider understanding and appreciation of the fact that the world is not as God would wish it to be. The values of God's upside-down kingdom reveal the selfishness and the self-serving nature of the values of the world. One paraphrase that we find of this verse is this: "Blessed are those that cry out to God for the injustices and sorrows in the world. So this is the morning of lament. This is the passionate cry of intercession for those who suffer because of the way that the values of the world have marginalized or excluded others. We should be those who are concerned for justice. And the root word for justice is the one that we have translated as righteousness so often in the New Testament. This is a kingdom value. And this, by and large, is restorative justice. It's not punitive justice. It's restorative justice. Jesus comes first and foremost to put things right. So we're called to be the kinds of people who have recognized our own spiritual need, and then those kinds of people who display a passionate desire to not only tell other people about the wonderful news of God, but also to be willing to be used by God to set about readdressing the injustices we see around us. The Jewish culture that Jesus was born into had this rich history of mourning, of practicing lament. It stretched back hundreds and hundreds of years before he was born. The prophets, the Psalms, all include poems, don't they, and songs and speeches that recount the words of the people gathering together for public worship. And when they do it, publicly, they mourn. And this mourning isn't the kind of crying that we have about a bad day or bemoaning some frustration at home or at work. This mourning that Jesus is talking about is referencing the kind of thing that is a response to injustice and oppression. Those who mourn the negative impact of the powers, both material and spiritual, on the lives of the most vulnerable. And I don't think there's anything passive about these two verses. I don't think we're being called to be spiritual ascetics. We aren't called to sit around and pity our spiritual paucity and mourn over our own sinful nature. Although it's right, of course, that we come and we confess our sin to God. But reading it just in those ways, I think, is a misreading of the text. That would become rather like a worm-like theology that leads to self-pitying stagnation and paralysis. But instead, we're called to fully embrace our citizenship of God's kingdom. We're called to follow the example of the King. We're called to be involved in the pain of the world, and we're called to allow that pain to shape our discipleship. And then we get to the word comforted at the end. You see, the word comforted in this context, as in so many other places that we read it in Scripture, doesn't describe a warm hug and a softly spoken there. It's nothing like that at all. It means something entirely different. Comfort, in this sense, is an encouragement to keep going, and it's a reassurance of help and power. That's what it means. It's this spur to action. It's this assurance of inner strength to carry on. It's a strength that we can only know through God's indwelling Holy Spirit. It's a strength we can only know when we recognize our paucity of our own spirit, that we can do nothing unless God is working within us. Just as we close, and Chris is going to lead us in prayer in a moment, we're going to think about some of these things and what these verses bring to our hearts and to our minds. And also we'll look back at that parable again. But as we close, let's just read again Jesus' words as translated for us by Trom Wright. And let's take these attitudes to heart. Let's take them into the varying contexts of our daily life. Let's certainly apply them personally, as we recognize that we can do nothing without God, as we recognize that we are those who should mourn our sinful life. But let's move on from that. And let's recognize that we can take these things into the daily life and experience of our lives in increasingly practical ways. This is what he says. Wonderful news for the poor in spirit. The kingdom of heaven is yours. Wonderful news for the mourners. You're going to be comforted.